So this is Craig MacArthur Dolezel, and I'm speaking with Len Carew on November 10th, 2016 at the Actors Fund in New York City. This is Oral History 2 of 3 for the Actors Fund. Len, thanks for speaking with me again.
Pleasure.
So, thinking of your career, is there a certain period of time or project that stands out to you as a turning point?
Well, there were, I think there's, when I first went to Stratford, Ontario, and I realized from being there that year that that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to do the classics. I didn't think when I went, I had no idea what I would play in Shakespeare, you know, other than Romeo or, you know, Prince Hal, maybe, something like that. And when I got there and realized that if you knew how to translate Shakespeare to a modern ear, to make it, to give them a sense of what it was you were saying, because you were falling, you know, it was falling on ears that had never heard this kind of language before. Except what they'd studied in school, and you know, and obviously part of the audience was not totally ignorant of Shakespeare, but and they welcomed it immediately. You know, the audience did, the town didn't, but that's a whole other story. But after that first year, I came back to Winnipeg and I said to John, that's what I want to do. I want to do the classics. I said, I understand now that that's where the challenge is for an actor lies. You know, it's like the majors in golf, or, you know, you want to do those plays that really challenge you, that really stretch you, that really make you learn something about yourself, that make you stretch the instrument and really realize that it, you are an instrument, and it's a sacred thing that you're involved in. It's very spiritual. It was to me. And I, it was like religion, in a sense, to me, because it was, it needed all that care, it needed all that enlightenment. You had to, I mean, I didn't have a college education, I had a high school education, and so I was, you know, I was feeling a little ignorant, if you will. I'm thinking, I don't really know what the fuck I'm doing here, so I better smarten up. And so I went to rehearsal every day and watched these guys work and read a lot of Shakespeare and listened to these wonderful directors and actors. And I realized that's what I really wanted to do. So that was the first step, and I came back to Winnipeg that winter and told John that, John Hirsch, that that's what I wanted to do. And he said, well, he said, you're taking the high road. He said, it's not gonna be easy, you know, because there's not many places you can do it in this country. There's Stratford, there's the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis now, which is a rep theater like Stratford is. And I said, yeah, well, then I'm gonna try and get to the Guthrie in Minneapolis, because that's where Guthrie was, had been, and, you know, he'd been there and founded the place, and so when I got the opportunity to go there, when Douglas Campbell came to, who was, after Guthrie left, Campbell became the artistic director of Stratford, of the Guthrie, and he came to Stratford and saw me and invited me to come to the Guthrie. And I got resistance from some of the actors in the Stratford company who didn't want me to go. They just said, you know, you gotta, what about our theater, you know? And I thought, well, I said, I've been given an opportunity here that I don't think I can ignore, is to lead a company of actors at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. I said, I think I'd be an idiot not to take it. So I just said, you know, and they said, well, you know, you've got, this is our national theater and you're an up-and-coming star in this business. And frankly, I wasn't moving up in the company as much as I wanted to. But because there were a lot of guys ahead of me and they'd been there and they were waiting their turn. And so it was a really small, you know, opportunity. And it looked like my calculations, I thought, well, Christ, you know, it's going to be another 2 or 3 years before I ever get into leading roles in this, you know, in Shakespeare. So when he offered me the lead in As You Like It, I said, yeah, I've got to go. And that was really the turning point, I think, in my life when I got there. And I was the leader of the company, and I led it well. And everybody there embraced me and said, welcome, thank you so much. So it was absolutely the right time for me to do that. And, you know, and then I got there and I said, well, I'm here now, so I'm gonna apply for a, you know, for a visa and hopefully get a green card so I can work here. And they helped me with that, the Guthrie Company did. And I got that status. And so, you know, I've been a resident alien of the United States since like 1963 or something like that. But that was really the turning point. When I got here and I knew what I felt I was going to be able to do became reality, and I thought, okay.
When we last spoke, you mentioned that when you were at the Guthrie, you set it up so everybody could start doing voiceover auditions in Chicago, which makes me curious to know about how you felt about moving into different mediums, into voiceover and into television, and how that transition went for you.
Well, you know, we were in Minneapolis, remember? So those they were looking to make the advertising people were looking to make to get on the map, as it were, and everything had to go through Chicago at that point. And they wanted to change that, but they also wanted to have to make themselves viable. They needed a voice tape that they could send to Chicago and say, you know, here we got all these voices here. And I just said, well, I went to a woman who was an agent. And I said, you've got this absolute trove of people here. I said, you should put them all on tape. So you've got this, you know, and I said, because there's a lot of great voices, because that's what they do. That's how they've been, you know, they've trained those things and they can, you know, they're pretty smart. And she took me a while to convince her, but she finally was convinced. And I think it made a big difference for a few people, not everybody, but at least they were, you know, thinking a little bit outside the box, because they never thought that would, you know, would be what they might be doing. I know a couple of guys that did very, very well doing voiceovers from the Guthrie. So that was something that that I was just proud of that I was able to do. But that being at the Guthrie in the leading role as the leading actor of a company, it was what really was a turning point in my life.
Do you recall working on your first television or film project and what that transition of mediums was like for you?
Yeah, the first thing I did was here. It was in Montreal. And the film was called Blindness. It was about the CIBC, or the CNIBC. Canadian National Institute for the Blind, CNIB. And I had to, it was a story about a guy who got blinded. He wasn't born blind, got blinded. So he'd been living a normal life and then had an accident. My eyes were closed. I had one eye totally closed in makeup, you know. So I saw it in one little corner of this eye when we were filming. And I thought, this is really weird. Because I couldn't see anything. Or I couldn't see myself even. So I thought, well, I'm acting with my eyes shut. How would you do that if you couldn't see? So these became
your ears,
your eyes, you know, and they, you were very sensitive to sound, it seemed, it had to be. And I'd read a little bit about, I'd done some research, and that was something that I did. And I thought, well, and then when I saw the film, I was pleased with what had happened. I just thought, am I right or am I wrong? I don't know. But the director didn't go, oh my God, what are you doing? So that was all right. And then I got a film in Canada called One Man, which I won the Canadian Oscar for. At that time it was called an E-Trog, because that was the name of the guy, the designer of the award. And now it's called, what's it called? I'll think of it. But that was, I had the lead, you know, I was in every frame of that picture. And I think I learned a lot about how to work with the camera and you know, because you have to be careful, I think, theatrically. We want to, you know, when you're trying to express something in the theater, it's out there, and here the camera is there, and you know, and so you have to scale everything down, if you will, in your head. I had to, anyway. That was the way I looked at it. I think you just scale it down and let. I started to pay more attention to actors on film. To see how they, you know, see if there was some kind of routine or method that they used. One of the things that I noticed most of all was Paul Newman, who never really looked at you. He would look where I'm looking now at you. Or it would never be this, the connection that you have to make in the theater. The eye-to-eye connection can be, fuck you, rather than fuck you. You know, that, and I thought, that's interesting. So, I'll have to try and apply that along the line somewhere, which I think I was able to do. So where are we? I'm a kind of...
Well, I would love to hear if your technique has changed, or if you feel your technique has changed from the time you started with theater and moving into the medium of film and television, if they've influenced each other, or...
Yeah. Well, the acting instinct is the same, you know, as it is on the stage. It's just you have to be... and it kind of evolves. The way you work in film and television. So there was no, you know, there was no strict kind of rule that I went to. I just kind of remembered that what your instinct tells you to do, which I've always trusted, and what my gut instinct was, how emotionally I should approach things, because I had to approach everything I felt from an emotional point of view, no matter if you were being the cool cucumber or the firebrand. It all had to come from the gut somewhere. So that's really, I think, what evolved for me, is that I learned that I had to find out, I had to internalize everything. I had to find the emotional reason for doing anything, for any character, just for me, just to give me a sense of what that character might be about. So that was revelatory.
Can you tell me about a time where you really had to follow those instincts strongly and take a stand for yourself, perhaps on a project?
Well, maybe when we did Four Seasons, the film Four Seasons, which I did immediately after I did Sweeney Todd. I finished on Sunday, matinee, and Monday morning we were filming in the village. So I went from this, you know, Jacobean character. And the next day I was being me, in a sense. And, you know, a stud muffin guy, you know, who had, wife was driving him crazy, and so he was going to divorce her, because she was such a strange child. And that, I think, was Alan Alda wrote and directed it and cast me in it and said, you know, I said, well, you know, I've just been spent a year doing this thing. And he said, yeah, I know you have. I said, so watch me carefully. I may get a little, you know, too big. And he did. He watched me, and he said, "No, you're doing fine." Because I was terribly conscious of, you know, maybe being a little too theatrical, if you will. And this was the antithesis of Sweeney Todd. And it was really a genuinely funny film, and did fairly well at the box office. I think that was when I did that and saw the result of it. I thought, okay, I can do this too. I know how to do it. I don't have to be going, are you going too far? Are you going too far? Just the fact that you're monitoring yourself, this seems to be enough.
Do you have a particular memory from being on a set that strikes you as momentous?
Oh, the only thing I remember, we went to the Virgin Islands to film the summer sequence. And, you know, you should go to the Virgin. This is where Alan used to go on his hiatus from MASH. And, you know, it's Nirvana, it's really, but you shouldn't go there to make a film. You should go there, you know, to fuck your brains out, and, you know, and do that and have a really wonderful time and loll around and, you know, eat whenever you wanted to eat and just... So these people were not terribly fond of us, you know, and we were a big bunch of people and bringing them an awful lot of money. And you would have thought they would have been kissing our tuchus, but they were pretty nonchalant. And I remember when we first got there, you know, and at the end of a filming day, because we were out on boats, you know, and so you're out in the sun and when you're not filming, you're in another boat and, you know, waiting to get onto the boat to do the scene. And so when you get back to shore and we're done, you know, at the end of the day, and it's, I need a drink, right? And everybody would go and have, you know, we'd all go in and have a cocktail and then go and shower up and then make dinner plans. There were like five restaurants that you could go to. But I remember the first day, that this filming day, when we came back, and I mean, we were even on a first name basis with some of the waiters, you know. And there were other people there, but it didn't seem a lot of people were, we weren't there in the high season for them. So it seemed, you know, that they should be bending over backwards to help us, and they weren't. And I remember saying to this one fella, I ordered a drink, you know, we ordered a drink. It was Jack Weston and I, and maybe Carol Burnett. We were having a drink, and we ordered our drink, and 10 minutes went by, 15 minutes went by, and I said to him, I said, whoa, come here, and he ignored me. And another 5 minutes went by, and I put up my hand to, and he walked right on by. And he made the mistake coming back the other way to walk by me, and I tripped him with his drink order, and he went on his face into the ground. And I said, seems to me that's the only way I can get your fucking attention. I ordered a drink. We ordered a drink here 20 minutes ago. What the fuck is the matter with you people? And that, I'm afraid, was a big mistake. And they all kind of just said, well, we'll deal with these guys the way we deal with them. So virtually everybody's room got broken into. Yeah. Virtually every one of us guys came in, and they would send, you know, we had our places right on the ocean, and when we were away filming, the guys would come across and steal out of our rooms. And there was no way we could prove it, but we knew it was happening. So that was not a pleasant thing, but it was, you know, we weren't there forever, thank God.
How was it to work with actors that you knew on stage and then work together on camera?
It was, I guess, probably a little easier, if you would, than not knowing them. But, you know, actors are amazing creatures. When we filmed the pilot of Blue Bloods, we filmed it in Toronto. And every episode of the show, there is a dinner scene. The family dinner scene at our home, which my son and I share. It was the home he grew up in. He lost his wife, I lost my wife, moved in together. Every Sunday we have a dinner, and it's kind of mandatory to be there. So the first day we were filming them, the producer put that scene on as first up. And we all went, wait a minute, why are we doing this first? We don't even know one another, you know. I mean, we didn't know one another. So, and there's 9 of us sitting around the table. And we're all supposed to be, you know, a really close-knit family. So we had to make up some backstory pretty quick. And because of the kids, the producer said, well, I've got these kids, you know. And he said, I got to get them in and out. And so it had to be first. And he said, good luck. So we all kind of grabbed, you know, we've got one another's back. And we made up a backstory and for ourselves. And then we filmed it. And he came back to us the next day and said, it's great. It works great. The family scene, he said, you'd never know that you guys had just met. He said, really, it's quite amazing. And I never saw it, but Tom went to look at it. Tom said, I'm a son of a bitch. It really worked. It really worked. You know, and he said, congratulations to us all that we were able to do that, you know, in half an hour almost, before they started filming. And so that was pretty amazing. That's what I think is... I forget what I said. I told you that story.
Well, it leads me to wondering if you could tell me about your criteria for success as an actor.
Well, I don't know if... if there's criteria. Well, you've got to look at the content of what you're going to play. In other words, the script's got to be good. It's got to have good writing. It's got to have... because, you know, we can do anything. We can make anything work. But sometimes it's just the dialogue is so fucking awful that you know, you make it work, but you go, oh, Jesus Christ. So the criteria, if you will, kind of comes with the territory. It's different for each script. First and foremost, it's got to be intelligently written. That's all. And the story's got to have, you know, some kind of beginning, a middle, and an end. You know, that's why we make 45-minute movie every week. I guess there's a was a solution, if you will, for the writers, that how they, you know, how they break the thing down and put it back together. But you know, even Four Seasons, for instance, was a wonderfully comic film, really, honestly, funny film that Alan wrote, Alan Alda, and so it kind of, because it was good, and we were, most of us, stage actors. We'd all been stage actors at one point. Jack West and Rita Moreno, Carol Burnett, myself, Bess Armstrong, Alan Alda. Sandy Dennis. So we were all basically, you know, stage actors. And so it kind of took care of itself, if you will. And I think everybody, you know, who individually had a pretty good sense of what the camera does now, Sandy, you know, so I don't have to work so hard. So criteria, I think, comes with each one individually.
I would love to hear more about your relationship with critics over the course of your career.
Crickets.
With crickets.
That was Hal Prince's favorite, the crickets. Well, you know what? I don't read criticism, because if you believe the good stuff, you've got to believe the bad stuff, it seems to me. So why bother? The only criteria you have is your own. The only thing that makes sense to me is, did I put the author's thoughts on the stage and you know, playing the scene right? So I, you know, I mean, I've got obviously lots of I think, well, you'll probably see a lot of them. the reviews of stuff over the years, but I didn't pay a lot of attention to them. Because John Hirsch early on said, you know, be careful about stuff. Don't be taking that praise too, you know, too cavalierly. And because it's the first film I did with Mr. Roberts, I got wonderful reviews. Those I read, you know, it was my first time. I went, shit. I was right. I can do this. But after that, I just didn't read them. Because it seemed to me that if you liked the good stuff, when they said, you stink, you'd have to believe that too. And you want to go, well, how could you think that was good and this wasn't good? So I said, I'm not going to read them anymore. I have, you know, a lot, you know, at the end of each summer at Stratford and the Guthrie, I would take, you know, I'd say to the publicity people, just make, you know, a package of the reviews so I'll have them from my archives. So I don't know. The first I have, I think I told you last time, I read after the opening of Applause, which was the first musical. I read those reviews because it was my first musical, you know. But then I thought, no. That's nice. It's nice. I'm glad they like me. So that's all I needed to know, you know, and close the book and go on from there. And that's pretty much the way I've operated.
If you could give some advice to a younger person who's considering going into the arts, what would you share?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's got to be a burning in your belly. It's got to be something that you must do, because you're going to get rejection all the time. You know, it never stops. It still goes on with me, you know, getting rejected for things. But I've known that for a long time. I mean, for instance, I went to Hollywood when I was in my 20s and 30s. I went to Hollywood every pilot season for about 5 years until I finally said, hey, guys, I'm going to go get a career for myself in the theater. And because I obviously can't get arrested here doing this stuff. I said, this is 5 years in a row and I haven't even got a sniff. So I'm going to go away and live my life and become an actor. And maybe when I'm 70, I'll have a television show. And they all said, no, you got to come on. Well, when I was 70, I got blue bloods. So I think it's got to be something that you know is in your gut that you got to do. Your instincts, you know, some people have natural born instincts that way. And I think I did. I've always had that. But I was in a small city where there wasn't a lot of that kind of activity except amateur. And well, we had a symphony and a ballet company, the Royal Winnipeg Ballet. We had no professional theater until Hirsch started it. So, and I was part of that. What was the question again?
If you were to speak to a younger person.
I have on occasion gone to acting classes and done, you know. But my advice always is, you know, tell them little things about your own life and how that's evolved. I mean, I'd love to be able to say to them, get to a rep company, because that's really how you learn to be an actor. But of course, that's virtually impossible to do now. Primarily, it's got to be burning a hole in your gut, and so you've got to work, and you must go into the regional theaters and learn your craft. Don't, you know, this city, for instance, has always been a finisher city. They don't want beginners. They're not interested in beginners. They want people that can deliver like that. And when I got here, I had all this classical experience. And everybody went, Jesus, who is this guy? Where did he come from? Well, we came from when the regional theaters were formed, and there was a whole movement to go into the regionals. and to the Guthrie, and for, you know, it was virtually a theater in every major city in the country. And that, by the way, was primarily based on what John Hirsch did. He said, this is how you got to build your company. You must do, you know, you must do a comedy, a musical, and then in the next year add maybe a drama, and then add Shakespeare as you go on, you know, and you building an audience. And so that was basically, he really had the model for virtually every regional theater in North America. Everybody went, yeah, that works. It works. So they all adopted that kind of balance in their season, you know. And they ran them for a couple of weeks to begin, and then 3 weeks, and then a month, you know, like that. And the regional theater movement was huge. In the 60s and early 70s. And we all came, you know, we all came to New York with all this experience. And we'd all done virtually everything. So there wasn't anything that, you know, they could throw at us that was new. And that was, I think, very important. Because right then in 69, 70, and 71, there was virtually an invasion from the regional theaters of actors coming back, coming to New York that had, you know, that had been away and nobody knew who they were. They'd been there owning their craft, and they arrived full blown on the scene, and everybody, you know, directors and producers were going, whoa, what's going on here? Oh, this is really good. We don't have, you know, we don't have to go to England maybe anymore, you know. We've got guys that can do that here. And I think that was a very big deal in the late 60s, early 70s. So a lot of actors just appeared as if they'd been doing it forever. And of course they had, except they'd been doing it in the boonies and not on Broadway. And so there were stars being born, if you will, left, right, and center, you know. I mean, I remember reading, I think I said this last time now, quite frankly, Clive Barnes's review of Applause, and praising me and then saying, I wonder if it's because he was trained as a classical actor. Could it be something like that? He said something like that. So, you know, you go, ah, somebody's paying attention. Somebody knows, you know, what's going on.
This leads me to wonder, that it's always, it feels important to be engaged, especially as an artist, especially at all parts of your career.
Mm-hmm.
And you are currently engaged in a television show right now. Are you doing anything else creatively, artistically?
Yes.
And how does that inform you, and how does that...
Well, in January of this year, off-Broadway, at the Lion Theatre, I did an evening called Broadway and the Bard, which I created along with Barry Kleinfort and Mark Janis. Something that I've been thinking of since Henry V and Applause, 1969. That is to do an evening of Shakespeare and song. Take some of the great soliloquies and find a Broadway show tune that either made a comment about the verse or supported it. And so, yeah, that was great fun to put together. We put together, I think it was about 16 one-act plays. Because I picked for the most part all the soliloquies, roles that I played. And of course, you know, at this point, everybody in New York forgot where I came from. If they ever knew or gave a shit, they probably didn't, but... I had this virtually 15-year career before I ever came to New York. And I had a great time putting that together. We had a great time putting it together. It was about 75 minutes, one-act play, really. But it was a piece of theater. It had to be done as a piece of theater. I didn't want to do it in a cabaret setting. I needed the lights and I needed the drama of it because I'm doing a lot of, you know, pretty interesting Shakespearean stuff, both comedy and tragedy, and history plays. And that was great fun to put together. And we ran it for 6 weeks at the Lion Theater. And I'm hoping that next summer I'm going to take it to the Edinburgh Festival. And I would like to do it again here in New York, in a different venue. So yeah, that was, I mean, it took me a long time to finally get it, you know, put it together. But there was always something else going on in my life, so I never really gave it its proper attention. Until finally I just said, you know, about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I said, I'm gonna do this. And so we got together and put this thing together.
And how do you feel that, how do you feel continually engaging in artistry influences you or affects your health, your being, as a living creature, what does it do for you?
Well, it's I think absolutely essential. I think that it's it's like breathing. And once we started working on this thing, it just went boom, like this, you know. And funnily enough, I had heart surgery just before I did this. Actually, it's now 3 years ago. I had the major valve replaced. I have a history of aneurysms in the family. It's an Irish thing, I think. And all my siblings have had them. And my mother had one, who was the Irish part of the family. She died of a ruptured aneurysm. So it's in the DNA, and we've been monitoring it forever. I had what's the word I'm looking for? I had an aneurysm in my stomach that we got rid of, and then I was going to have, we had an aneurysm we were watching that was behind my heart, and we've been monitoring it for, you know, forever. And about 3 years ago, I said, "Okay, let's look at it," you know, because every 6 months I would go and to my cardiovascular guy and say, you know, let's take a look. It's 6 months have gone by. And he said, well, it's gotten a little bigger. Why don't we take it out? And I said, yeah, okay. I had time. I was on the hiatus of it. Actually, it wasn't. We were still in production, but I had like a 10-day period where I wasn't working. And I went in to get clearance to have the aneurysm done, and they found blockage in my aorta. And so I said, he said, this is no longer a choice. You must have this operated on. So we did. And it was done. I was in and out of the hospital in about 5 days, 6 days. And I never missed an episode. And then the summer in June, the aneurysm, we did the aneurysm. So that's, you know, through all of that, I was asymptomatic, it seemed to me, about, you know, shortness of breath. And until finally, there was a hill going up from our place to a restaurant. It was pretty steep. And one day we were going up there and I went, whoa. It's off a hill and I was going, whew. So I went to see the doctor and he said, let's do this.
Is there a role that you have not had an opportunity to do or one that you would like to revisit?
Yeah, I'd like to revisit Prospero. I never got to play Richard III. Or Richard II, for that matter. It was something that I did in understudy rehearsal. I understudied Richard II at Stratford, but never got to play it. Lear I've done twice. I think it might be, I wouldn't mind having another go at it. As tough as it is. but that's the challenge. Now I'm at least close to his age.
Could you tell me what the appeal would be in revisiting those roles?
Well, they're just wonderful roles. They're just incredible pieces of writing. And, you know, I did it the first time when I was 35 at the Guthrie. And it changed my life, really. Because, of course, you think, well, I don't think I can play this. But Michael Langham said to me, oh, well, he said, sure you can. I said, sure you can. He said, because, you know, what? I said, what about the senior members of our company when you're going to play King Lear and I'm going to play King Lear? What do you think they're going to say? And he said, well, I know them pretty well and they'll go, oh, thank God they didn't ask me to do it. He said, because it's a bear of a role. It's a very, very difficult role. And you know, he said, you physically can handle it. And he said, I don't think the other two guys could. What it needs, you know, because it's the man's in full rage, you know, after his kids dump him. And he goes mad. And of course, it was true. But it just makes you, when you're playing these roles, it just redefines you in a way. Because, you know, you have your doubts about whether you can do it or not. And if you have people who believe in you, as I did, you think, well, I'm doing it, so I'm out here, so I'd better, you know, give it my best shot. And you think I've got the guns to do it, okay, then let's make sure I do. And so I had the guns all right to do it. But it was something that was, I was very conscious of being 35 years old and trying to play 80. These are great weapons. These are, you know, your hands are enormously evocative. And I had 35-year-old hands. And I said to the designer, whose name was Desmond Healy, who had designed the costumes, I said, you know, these hands, I said, they just, every time I look at them, I go, you know, these are 35-year-old hands. I can't hide them. And he said, well, I'll paint them for you. So he painted age into my hands. And I said, well, that's great, but, you know, what am I going to do tomorrow? I said, I can't do this. He said, well, I'll do it a few times, and you watch. He said, you'll be able to do it. I'll show you how. And it worked. It took that thing off my, took it off my back that I had these, I didn't have these 35-year-old hands anymore. And this man, Mr. Healy, used to come in and paint my hands before we were in rep. He would come in, and he was resident in the company as, you know, resident designer. And he would come to my dressing room and paint my hands for like the first month. Because we weren't doing it every day, you know, we were doing it in rep, so it was only, and he said, hey, it's only three times a week, you know, and I'm going, yeah, but this is ridiculous. But funnily enough, we're honoring him on Saturday. He died a few months ago. And I'm going to tell that story about him, and I'm going to do Lear. I'm going to do the last section of Broadway and the Bard. Because it includes Lear and Prospero, which he also designed. So just as a, you know, in memoriam for him. And I'm going to tell that story that I just told you, that he painted my hands. And that made a huge difference to me. I thought, oh yeah, now these hands look 80 years old. You know, because I had the wig on and I had the beard, and, you know, but these hands were a dead giveaway, it seemed to me. And when he did that, it made it all the difference in the world to me.
Cool. I think this is a wonderful place to stop for today.
Okay.
Yeah. Let me do this real quick. Is there anything that you would like to think about for next time specifically?
We're going to do another one of these sessions.
Last one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there anything you would like to personally touch upon?
Well, I'll give it some thought. Yeah, I'll give it some thought. Now, let's think about... next session. It should obviously be not at 11 anymore.